I'm Renee Von Medding. Welcome to Disordered, a podcast about food, our relationship with our bodies, and learning to live and love yourself again. I am not an expert in eating disorders, but I am someone who has lived with one for almost two decades. I'm not here to give medical advice, but simply to try and unpick some of the complexity of disordered eating through a series of conversations I will have with people who are speaking from first-hand experience. Disordered eating will impact each and every one of us at some point in our lives. I want to delve deeper. At what point does disordered eating become an eating disorder? Through looking closer at the spectrum of these mental illnesses, I hope that you will be challenged in your own view of what an eating disorder looks like. In this week's episode, I speak to Clara, who was diagnosed with anorexia in her teens. Now in her early 20s and studying to be a psychiatric nurse, Clara is an inspiration to those around her. I hope that her story fills you with the same hope it did for me. Hi, Clara.
Hello.
Thank you so much for coming in and talking to me, and I'm so excited to meet you in person.
I know. Thank you so much for having me. When you text me, I was so on board. You're like, oh, you know, if you want to think about it. I was like, no, just tell me what day.
I know, right away. You were like, I'm coming in. Yeah. Very, very happy and honored that you're going to share your story with me and with us. I am just going to start with a really easy question, okay, which is, where are you from and where did you grow up?
So I am from North County Dublin. Mm-hmm. I would struggle to find my way outside of anywhere past Northside, to be honest. I'm out in the Donabate area at the moment by the beach, and I grew up in St. Margaret's. It's this little area that usually nobody knows of. It's the back of the airport, and it's in between a lot of areas. It's like literally just in the middle of nowhere, like in between Finglas, Ballymun, Santry, Swords. So it's a good mix.
And did you have brothers and sisters growing up? What was the kind of family setup?
So I have a very blended background, I think, yep, is what they call it nowadays. Yep. A very modern family. So I am, depending on what part of the family I'm with, I could be the only child, the eldest child, or the middle child, depending on what family I'm with.
Yep.
So I'm my mom and dad's only child. They separated when I was 2 and a half. So me and my mom lived with her parents, my grandparents, until I was 11, I think. And yep, I was an only child, an only grandchild. My dad got remarried and he has three kids. So I have two younger sisters and a younger brother. And then my mom got remarried. Didn't have any more kids, but her partner had kids from a previous marriage.
Okay.
So I've a younger stepbrother and an older stepsister. But for me, like, there's no halves or steps.
Absolutely.
We're brothers and sisters.
I totally agree. I would never, I totally, totally agree with that. So yeah, big, big family. So you were an only child up until 11. And can you remember, like, back before anything kind of started, can you remember, like, what was your favorite thing to do as a child?
I loved Barbies, because maybe that explains the I loved, like, I was just really like a girly girl little child. But in saying that, though, I did like me Hot Wheels cars.
Yeah.
So yeah. But I loved, like, I had my baby born, my baby Annabelle, my baby Choo Choo. A really good mix, you know. I loved my dolls and stuff. I loved my cars. And then also, as a child, I got into healing crystals.
Wow, that's very advanced.
And yeah, there was like this angel shop near where my nan worked. And I just...
Well, I get that. Like, it's really, you know, they're all really shiny. And as a child, and I'm sure you kind of, as a child, you pick up on a lot of energies and stuff.
Yeah, so I just loved the idea that, like, they had, like, healing properties.
Yeah.
And you know, they could make the room feel calmer.
Yeah.
So like, I'd wash them every week and stuff, and salt and
wow,
water. And I was that child, like, oh no, I can't come out to play yet.
I'm
washing
with my
crystals.
Yeah. For most people who develop an eating disorder, you can remember the time when things changed for you almost to the moment, when you started thinking in terms of black and white, all or nothing. When food stopped being something to be enjoyed and instead became both a weapon and a reward. For some people, it's a slow process, perhaps triggered by some innocuous comment that a family member made about your weight or food habits. For others, it's a sudden moment that could perhaps be set off by a traumatic event in their life. It's never the same for anyone, but it's always a turning point.
When did things change? Like, do you remember exactly the moment when things started to change, and what were kind of the events that led up to things changing?
To be honest, like I was diagnosed with an eating disorder when I was 15. But the older I get, and I suppose the more work I do on myself, I really realise that it was actually such a huge issue, like, way before then. But it's hard because things are so normalised, which was really challenging because you think it's normal. Like, you think it's normal to feel that way.
And how old are you now?
I am 23. I think as a child, you know, you're not really aware of things like how you look and stuff, and I think that's good, like, it's great. But I know that, like when I say I was a baby, like, I would have ate everything. Like, the only thing I never didn't like was potatoes, and that still goes on, like, unless they're in chips, I'm not going there. And then I know when my parents separated, that all changed, and I was a baby, so I suppose, you know, like, at that age, you don't have the you don't have the words to be able to say, like, I'm not okay, or, you know, I'm not feeling okay. So that's why certain behaviors and stuff can emerge. And for me, it was food. So I stopped eating. And then I was very fussy after that, like, very fussy. And it wasn't until I got a bit older that I'd start trying more foods and stuff. But I remember being probably like 9 or 10, maybe. And I used to go swimming with my mom and my nan in, like, this local community pool. And they had a gym, but you had to be 14 to join.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't go. And I remember being that age and thinking, like, okay, like, just 4 more years, just 3 more years, because I really wanted to go, because I, like, even at that age, I suppose I thought, like, oh, you know, I could do with losing weight.
Yeah.
Which when you think back now, like, when I think back now, it's just so sad.
It's so
because
sad.
I couldn't, like, looking at a child that age, you couldn't possibly tell them, oh, you need to lose weight or something. But yet, that's what I was feeling and telling myself at that age.
Eating disorders do not discriminate. There is this misconception that they are an illness that only affect young white girls. That is simply not true. You can be any age, any race, any sex, and from any background. The process of being diagnosed looks different for everyone, but for most people in Ireland, a clinical diagnosis of an eating disorder will come through your GP as the first port of call. From there, your GP can refer you on to whatever mental health services are available in your area with the view to either outpatient or inpatient treatment.
Okay, so you said you were formally diagnosed when you were 15.
Yeah.
Was that a long process? Were your parents kind of talking to you about this? Were your friends talking, or your other family members? Were people worried about you? Or was it kind of all of a sudden, one of your parents was like, we need to do something?
It was quite quick. I mean, I suppose, like, we were quite a typical Irish Catholic family, so
don't talk about anything.
Nothing was really spoken about. That has gotten better, I have to say. Mm-hmm. Like, when I went to hospital and stuff, you know, we had great help from, like, social workers and stuff, who would, like, you know, really showed us how to, like, because I think a lot of things, we didn't know how to have these conversations. In fairness, it was quite a quick process. Well, I don't know now if it was. So, like, I suppose when I was in first year,
so you'd have been about 12,
secondary school, I was 13.
Yeah. 13 going 14, I think, coming to the summer holidays, I in my own head, like, I wouldn't have told anyone about this. I was kind of like, okay, I kind of want to lose a bit of weight. And that was fine. Like, you know, it wasn't in a disordered way that I'd done it, really. Well, I suppose the fact that I was that age and doing it would suggest it was disordered.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just upped my exercise a little bit and I didn't really, like, stop eating. I more so would, like, okay, you can have foods like chocolate and crisps and stuff on weekends.
Like rewards.
Yeah, pretty much. So, okay, disordered.
Yes, now. Absolutely. You know, and that's the thing, like, you know, diets are disordered.
Completely.
They are. It's, you know, it's withholding things that your body needs. Like, we need all of the foods, just not all of them in huge amounts or tiny amounts, you know?
Exactly, yeah. And then that was fine. Like, I went back to school in second year, was doing great, loved school. I was just always really into school, really loved school. And, like, my eating was fine, you know, once I was in school and stuff. And I suppose I probably struggle with that as well, as, you know, when you're not in school, you don't have lunch breaks.
Yeah.
So you don't have that routine. Second year was fine, and then halfway through second year, not even, so I think it was like late November, early December, my dad told me that he was going into rehab for alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been an alcoholic, like, realistically, like, as long as I could remember, but, like, to me, that was my normal, so I didn't necessarily identify, oh, my dad's an alcoholic, because
your baseline was that was what he had always been.
Now, I knew that, like, in the past few years, like, things had been worse and, like, he had been drinking more, but at that age, you're not really thinking, is my dad an alcoholic? You know, like, because you're not thinking about that. So he was like, oh, yeah, I'm going into rehab. And it was kind of a surprise. Like, it was a little bit of a surprise. And there was just a whole load of emotions with that, because, like, on one hand, I was so relieved that, you know, oh, like, this can be the chance for things to change. And I was so, so proud, like, of the fact that he was able to, you know, say, okay, I'm not okay and I need help with this. But then on the other hand, it was very uncertain. Like,
yeah, it's scary for a parent to suddenly kind of be effectively gone from your life, and you don't know what the outcome
is it going to be successful or, like, okay, say if he goes and he gets sober, but will he be able to maintain that at home? Like, you're hoping for that, but you don't know. And that uncertainty is hard.
Yeah,
and
it's out of control.
Yeah, that's the thing you don't have control over. And I've always, like, always would have been known as an anxious child. And I would have had to have things planned out. And even, like, my mom would still say to me now, like, when I was little, say if we were going somewhere the next day, and I'd be like, Mommy, because we shared a room because we were my grandparents.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, Mommy. And she'd be like, what, Clara? I was like, so if this person says this, I'll say this, but then if they say this, I'll say that. And she'd be like, oh my, like, relax.
It's fine. Like, but you wanted to know what was going to happen.
Had to have these things planned out. So that was really hard to not be able to do that. And that was, like, the first Christmas as well that, like, I didn't get to see him. And, like, that was hard, but it was harder not being able to see my siblings because they were still quite young. So, you know, like, not being able to physically see them and, like, what Santa got them and stuff.
Well, I'm sure it felt kind of like your family was just kind of torn apart.
Yeah. And it was weird because I was like, oh, it's fine. And then it was Christmas Day and I was like, oh, this is
not
great.
Fine.
Yeah. And, like, I remember I went to visit him in rehab. I went down once and he was just... Like, it was great to see him, like, doing so well, like, because he'd done really, really well. Like, he got off the drink, he stayed off the drink, and, like, he really engaged in his program and, like, was really actively working to get better and stuff. But for me, like, I felt like there needed to be an acknowledgement of what had gone on the years before.
And as much as I was like, yeah, this is great and the future is going to be better, I still needed to like have those conversations around the past.
Yeah.
But that just didn't happen. So that was really hard because I was like, I'm happy for you, but I'm also annoyed and I'm upset, and you feel like you can't verbalize
that. And then you had nowhere to put all of that.
Yeah. And then like you go into school the next day, and I remember just kind of looking around me, and everyone was like, oh, like I had a gala match at the weekend, and or like, oh, I went out with my mom and dad and done this. And I was like, oh my God, like I visited my dad in rehab.
Yeah.
Like I just, I can't relate to any of this. That was a lot to deal with. I was 14 at this stage. Also started to like being interested in boys.
Yeah.
And then they don't always like you back. And then you're dealing with all of this, that, and you're like, God, like, why don't they like me? So with all of that going on, I just kind of had this idea like, oh, maybe if I was skinnier, I would feel better about myself. And if I felt better about myself, maybe like these problems wouldn't feel as big as they are. So I set out about that, trying to be skinnier, and it just...
So you remember kind of consciously saying, I'm going to be skinnier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then that just, it worked fantastically well, unfortunately, that it just completely took over. It was a very lonely time because it started as just, oh, eating a bit less and, you know, doing a bit more exercise. That completely blew up, where it would come to like, that summer then, and friends be like, oh, you know, you want to come over and have a sleepover,
and you wouldn't go because
it interferes with your workout regime, and it's just such a lonely time. I was quite good at covering it because I'd wear baggy clothes, but then of course the clothes don't fit anymore, and it becomes obvious. And as well, like, my moods were so bad, of course, because I wasn't eating. So like I was
your
just
brain can't yeah, function, you can't like function literally at all.
I was so snappy, so irritable. And I remember one time like my mom would kind of make comments then. She'd be like, you know, like you look off, like you don't look well. Like you look so skinny, you look sick. But to be honest, I was like,
how did that make you feel? Like, did that make you feel like you had done well? Like, you were
Because I was like, what I'm hearing is you're saying I'm skinny.
Which is what you wanted. So she thought, like, her kind of saying, you look like you're on the point of death. And to you, you're like, woohoo.
Yeah, it's working.
Mission accomplished. Yeah. Some people start the journey to recovery, and it's a fairly straightforward line. For many others, it's a very long road of progress and relapse. Often, relapses coincide with stressful periods in a person's life. Research has shown that specialist outpatient treatment represents the most effective and fastest way for most people with eating disorders to recover. The uneven road to recovery makes sense when you understand that an eating disorder isn't actually about weight. It's a psychological illness that serves as a means to deal with issues in a person's life. The other tricky thing about eating disorders is that many people never seek help, and those that do often find it difficult to access suitable treatment options. According to Bodywise, just 5 to 15% of people with eating disorders seek help. 85% of those report that it is hard to access treatment.
Late September or October, she was just like, look, I'm worried about you. You've lost an awful lot of weight, you don't look well. And I was just like, I'm fine, like literally like Ross from Friends, like was clearly
it's fine.
I'm fine. And she was just like, look, I'm gonna give you 2 weeks. If you can show me in these 2 weeks, because she was saying that I had to go to the doctor, and I was like, I'm not going to the doctor, I'm no way, I'm fine. So she said, okay, I'll give you 2 weeks. If you can show me in these 2 weeks that, you know, you're going to eat a bit more and really make a difference and make a change, we can work with that. So I was like, okay, perfect. I absolutely did not
have any intention.
No. And I came home 2 weeks later. Didn't even cop it was 2 weeks later. I came home from school and she was like, don't take your jacket off, we're going out. So
I was like, where are we going? She was like, we're going to the doctor. And I was like, no, I'm not going. She's like, it's already booked. So I knew then. But like going over, like I was kind of thinking, okay, like in my head, I was like preparing myself. Like, okay, like they might tell you that maybe you're suffering from like depression or something. Mm. And I went over and she was saying, the doctor, she was lovely, I have to say. Like she was really, really kind. Was asking me, like, what would I eat in a normal day?
And were you lying about it, or were you honest at that point?
I wasn't completely honest.
Sugarcoating it a bit.
Yeah. I was adding in a few things that I absolutely hadn't had in a long time.
Yeah.
And so she weighed me and all that and explained BMI to me. And she was just like, you're not well. You have an eating disorder. And I just, like, my mind was blown because in my head, like, it's so stigmatizing, but in my head, like, people in Ireland didn't suffer with things like that.
Mm.
And ordinary people didn't suffer with things like that. You know, that was Hollywood. That was, like, a million miles away.
It's kind of a glamorous thing.
Yeah.
That someone would go to, like, an expensive rehab in LA
yeah.
for.
There, yeah. Like, there was no way that, like, little old me over here had anorexia, like no. So that was, it was really strange, and I was like I think you're exaggerating a bit here. And she was like, okay, look, I'm gonna show you this scale. The optimal point is to be in the green. It's okay if you're in a little bit of the red on either side, but if you go too far into the red, it's really dangerous. So she was like, over here on this side, this red is like if you're overweight and then you go into the obese category. And then this side is like underweight and then like really dangerously underweight. And I was like, where am I? And she was like, you're off the scale. You're not on it anymore. And I was like, oh.
Like, and did that get through to you at all? Or was it still like, were you still a little bit happy about that?
It was definitely scary. Mm. But I still thought, like, oh, you're making too big a deal of this. Yeah. So then she tried to go down the route. She was like, well, when did you last have your period?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, God, like, now that you mention it.
I know, it's something that you don't even think about.
Yeah.
Until you actually realise that you haven't had one in years.
And I was kind of counting. I was like, oh, it's been a while. And she was like, how long? And I think at that stage it had been like 7 or 8 months.
Yeah.
So I told her that, and she was just like, Claire, you do realise that, like, this can affect you having children in the future. But I didn't care about that because, like my dad was out of rehab, so, like, I didn't have as big a role, I suppose, in looking after my brother and sisters that I would have had. So kids, I was like, I don't want to be near kids. Like, honestly, I was like, I don't care about that.
Yeah. But, like, when you're 15 or when you're, you know, even a young adult, like, you're not necessarily thinking about that.
Yeah.
You're thinking about the here and now.
Yeah, and I was like, I don't care. And like, I don't want kids. And she was like, yeah, but you say that now, Clara, you're only 15.
Yeah.
And I was just like, no, I don't want them. And then it was mad, really. Like, I went home that day and I just kind of said to my mom, I was like, is it okay if I take tomorrow off school? It's just a lot to process.
Yeah.
And I loved school, and she knew I loved school. And she was like, yeah, of course. So I text my friends. I was in it. There was a group. There was 4 of us, including me. And we were all really close. And I text them. And I was just like, look, I'm not going to be in tomorrow. My mom brought me to the doctor today. And I just found out that I have an eating disorder. So I just need a bit of time to get my head around it. And then they said to me, oh, did Miss whoever ring your mom? Like, refer to one of our teachers.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, why would she ring my mom? And they were like, we're really sorry, but they were like, we've been really worried about you. And we went to her and we told her that, like, what we've been noticing with you. And I was like, oh, God, isn't that a coincidence? Like,
and what did that make you mad?
No, it didn't actually. And they had said that to me. They were like, look, we're really sorry. Like, we know you're probably annoyed. And I was just like, God, like, I'm sorry that you have been that worried about me. Yeah. And I was like, I'm not annoyed at all, to be honest. I think that must have been a really hard thing for you to have to do, to go to a teacher and, you know, to make that known. So I was like,
like, thank you for, you know, for caring about me like that.
For anyone who has ever been in the position of seeking help for an eating disorder, there is clearly a huge discrepancy with demand versus what is available. Public funding to the tune of $1.5 million was made available in 2018, but only 137,000 of that was used. In 2019, $1.6 million was allocated. That year, none of that money was used. The HSE then confirmed that no new funding had been allocated in 2020. This means that to the time of this recording, almost no money has been spent developing the National Eating Disorder Plan, which was launched 3 years ago. It begs the question, are eating disorders really a priority for our health service?
They referred me to CAMHS, the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, but they had a waiting list. And even, like, this was like, God, like over 7 years ago now, so their waiting lists weren't anything like what they were at the moment. And even though, because I, the level of the illness that I was at, I went to the top of the
waiting list,
and it's still, I think it was still like over a month wait. So by the time I got to CAMHS, I'd actually lost more weight.
Yeah.
So
sure, when you're in that like place, even a couple of days,
exactly,
can make a huge difference.
Yeah. And like, I really did not want to go to CAMHS. I went because, you know, like your doctor tells you to do something, you're going to do it even if you don't want to.
Mm.
I was like, I don't want to go here. And I went, and like my very first session, they were like, yay, we need to admit you as an emergency case. I was just like, I
as
wouldn't
in,
have came
like, right
here.
Away?
as soon as a bed was available. And I was just like, man, I wouldn't have came here if I knew that's what was going to happen.
It's probably a good thing you didn't know.
Oh, definitely, yeah. So I was referred to three hospitals. Two of them were private. One was HSE. And that was kind of a worry because, like, we didn't have health insurance or anything. And I think people as well think that, like, oh, in Ireland, healthcare is free. Healthcare is absolutely not free in this country unless you want to wait years for treatment.
Or you just happen to be very lucky and
for
whatever reason, you get it quickly.
Yeah. So mom was kind of like, look, if she needs to go private, like, we can look at paying. And they were like, yeah, it's like €1,000 a week. And mom was like,
Jesus Christ.
Okay, yeah, no, we can't afford that. And they basically just explained that, like, where I was at, because if I wasn't admitted, like, my life was basically at risk. If I had to go into a private hospital, because it was whatever hospital had a bed first I was going to go to, the HSE would cover my costs, because if they didn't and I died,
it would be on them.
Yeah, it wouldn't look good. So in cases like that, the HSE will foot the bill. But it was actually the HSE hospital who had the bed first, so I was admitted.
And is this into like a ward that is specifically...
It was a hospital by itself, so it wasn't actually in like a general hospital.
Yeah.
It was just a child and adolescent mental health inpatient unit, and there was 7 beds, I think.
Yeah.
So it was really small. Like, when I was admitted, there was only 2 other patients there.
Okay.
There was only 3 of us. And that was a really quick process, I have to say. It was strange, because when they first said it to me, I was like, I'm not going. I was like, I'm absolutely not going.
Yeah.
And my mom was like, look, I don't want to force her to go if she doesn't feel comfortable, you know, like, can we not work on this, like, in the community here? And they were just like, no, it's gone beyond that. And then they said to my mom that if she wouldn't agree to sign me in against my will.
If you refuse to go.
Mm-hmm, because I was under 18, making me an involuntary patient was different. So they would actually basically take my mom to court and get custody of me.
Yeah,
so
become the guardians.
I would be in the care of the state. Yeah. So I was just kind of like, oh, that sounds like a lot of stress. Look, I'll go in. Because I didn't think I'd be there that long. I was like, I'll be in there a week or two. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
3 months.
Wow.
Yeah. But I mean, it was necessary. It absolutely was.
Accepting that you have a problem is a huge step for anyone facing disordered eating. If you do not accept that there is a problem, you will never be able to understand it, nor will you be able to change the behavior which is keeping you trapped in the cycle of addiction. Understanding that you have underlying issues that are fueling your eating disorder is the first step in your journey to recovery. So at what point in your kind of stay there, like, or was there a point where you kind of started to realize that this had become a huge problem and you kind of accepted that you had an eating disorder? Was there a moment, or did that come years later?
It was very early on, and I'm quite grateful that it was, I think. My first day was just, we'd had, like, so many family meetings and stuff. And I absolutely have a dark sense of humour, and I use my humour to cope with things. And I was, like, having this assessment done by, like, a doctor, a registrar. There were two nurses. There was a med student. There was just so many people. So I was, like, just trying to play it cool. Even though, like, everyone knew why I was there.
Yeah.
And I'd asked a question if my mom could bring food into me, like chocolate and stuff.
Yeah.
Because I have to say, like, you know, I never gave up my chocolate.
Yeah.
Like, I would always make allowances to factor that in. And the doctor was like, no, like, we need to monitor you really closely. So you're going to be on our meal plan, and it's going to be a very strict meal plan.
So we know exactly what.
And that didn't make sense to me, because I was like, but you want me to eat, why are you telling me that someone can't?
Yeah.
So then I made a joke. I was like, oh, are you afraid I'll ask her to bring me in empty wrappers and I'll tell you that I ate it? And just nobody laughed, and it was so awkward, because I was like, I thought it was really funny. And then a nurse came in, we had like a little break, and she was like, oh, we're gonna have lunch soon, I can't even remember the other option, but it was something, or chicken curry. And I was like, oh, I'll have the chicken curry. Thanks so much. Like, thinking, you know, she was like,
yeah,
thinking it was a choice.
Like, yeah.
And I went down to have this chicken curry. And to this day, like, I don't like chicken curry anymore because of this experience. She sat, and I'll always remember, she sat directly across from me.
Mm.
And it just felt very intimidating. I never understood why she didn't just sit beside me at the table, because she wasn't eating. So it made it that bit, oh, you're being watched. I knew, obviously, I was going to be watched, but I mean,
you didn't think it would be so confronting. Yeah, like,
just play it cool a little bit.
Yeah.
So I had like three or four mouthfuls. And I was like, oh, that was really nice. Thanks so much. Like, I have enough now. And she was just like, no, you need to eat more. I was like, oh, no, honestly, like, it was really nice, but
I'm full. Yeah,
I'm full. She was like, look, Clara, from now on, you're not going to be allowed to leave the table until you finish everything. And it just kind of hit me.
Mm.
And I remember, like, I just sobbed into that curry. And I was eating it while I was crying. And at one point, I kind of had to take a break. And, like, the dinner lady came over to take the plate. And the nurse was like, no, she's not done. And I was just, and I'd never really cried in front of anyone either. So yeah, I just felt really vulnerable. And then I had to have dessert after, and I was just like, oh my God, like, as if the
just
curry
like a
was...
weird form of torture.
Yeah. So I had that, and then I went back down to the room where my mom and dad were, and I just sobbed. I just cried so much.
Choosing the right treatment path for you can be vital in your recovery. It's tricky at the moment because so many of the face-to-face outpatient options have been cancelled. But despite it being difficult to access services, there is still help available. Do you think that that kind of path for you effectively saved your life?
Cause I know, definitely.
Yeah, because I know, like, for me, I never did any inpatient, and I was just very resistant to it, and I always refused to go, and I was never forced to go. I guess probably because my BMI, it was very, very low at one point, but it probably was not quite as low as where you were at. So I was never forced to do it. And thankfully, I managed to kind of cobble my way to some sort of recovery.
Yeah.
But I know for a lot of people, that is what saves them. So do you think that
for
that's
me,
for you?
Yeah, like, I would always describe it as being the best and worst experience of my life, because I mean, it's not nice having to go into a psych ward.
No,
especially I think at that age, you know, at 15, you just want to fit in, being carted off to an inpatient mental health hospital didn't really fit in with that. So I do think it was good, but I also think that's such a huge issue as well. And I think especially in the Irish mental health services is that unless your BMI is like really worrying, it's kind of like, oh, you know, they'll be okay. But like that...
That logic doesn't work.
No,
it really doesn't.
A BMI doesn't determine an eating disorder. I don't think people, and I think unfortunately, I don't think even healthcare professionals realize that like an eating disorder like is a condition of the mind.
Mm.
It can manifest physically, but even if it doesn't, that doesn't take away from the fact that it's a mental illness.
Absolutely. We were talking about this last week and like I've been just kind of thinking about it a lot, and there is such a hierarchy of eating disorders. It's like the anorexics are the worst, and then there's the bulimics, and then there's binge eaters, and it's like at one end it's like they're the worst,
yeah,
you know, and then on the other end it's like, oh, they're the people who just couldn't be bothered to make themselves sick or whatever it is, you know. And that's just not the case. Like your BMI and your weight does not determine how sick you are.
Exactly.
Like I was my sickest at some of the points that I was my heaviest.
Yeah. And like even like when I got out of hospital and everyone's like, oh, she's cured. No, I was absolutely not. Like, and there have been points where like I would have been, okay, realistically, I may not have been exactly a healthy weight, but I would have been maybe just under a healthy weight. So, you know, I wasn't really seen as that much of a risk, I guess. And like, I like really, really low. And it's just, it's unfortunate that still in this day and age, that isn't picked up on and acted upon, I think.
Recovery is a funny word when you are talking about an eating disorder. There are varying opinions on whether you can ever be fully cured or recovered from an eating disorder. Some believe that you can truly get better and go on to live a life free from any disordered thoughts. Others believe that eating disorders are like an addiction, and once an addict, always an addict. What is true for certain is that it is possible to get better and live a very happy life after an eating disorder, whether or not it's a recovery that needs to be maintained. That's something that I wanted to ask you was about recovery. And this is something that I kind of struggle with, because when I describe myself as someone with recovered from an eating disorder, I feel that's kind of not quite true, because I do consider myself to be an addict and to have that mindset of an addict. And as an addict, I can't remove myself from a world where there is food and where that is something that I have to live with and encounter and learn to enjoy even. So I don't believe that I am recovered. I am in a very good place right now, but I also am keenly aware of how easy it is to slip back into old habits. And, you know, when I encounter periods of stress or there's a trauma or, you know, things happen and life feels out of control, that is something that I would fall back on, you know. So like, do you consider yourself to be recovered, or how do you view?
I would absolutely agree with you and what you've said. Personally, I don't know if recovered exists. Mm-hmm. I think it's an ongoing process, and thankfully at the moment and recently in the past recent years, things have been great, and you know, it hasn't been that much of a struggle. Now I still have off days, of course, and we all do, but I work hard to keep myself this well. You know, you actively fight against that little voice of, oh well, you know, like there's no one at home, maybe you could skip lunch, and you know, but I know that if I don't fight that, like, where do I end up again? So no, I do think.
And what stops you? What do you think stops you? Like, is there, you know, do you have something that kind of just tells you, that life is so much more than that? Or do you have something that, you know, the thought of not being able to have kids, or is, I don't know, do you yeah. have something?
Like, because when I remember when I was like at my thinnest, how miserable I was. It didn't do anything. It didn't help anything. In fact, it made things worse. And then how far I've come now, and, you know, things really are, you know, pretty great, I have to say, like, thankfully. And I'm in a position now where, like, I know, like, I would love to have kids, not in the next year.
Not right now.
Yeah, not right now. But, like, that's definitely something, like, I really hope for. So there's just, there's too much to lose, I think. Yeah.
The word trigger is thrown around a lot these days. For those of us with a history of disordered eating, a trigger refers to a situation, a comment, a social media post, or anything that can cause us to relapse or have thoughts of a disordered nature. The world is filled with triggers, and learning to manage your triggers can go a long way towards maintaining your recovery.
I had a placement last year. I had 18 weeks of placement last year, and one of them in particular was just really tough. Going through it, it was really hard, and I lost a good bit of weight. And it wasn't intentional. It was because I was stressed and I was anxious all the time. And when you're stressed or when something's going on, I even just struggled to have an appetite because I would always feel anxiety and stuff in my stomach. And I remember there was one of the days and I was in there and I was like, God, I actually don't feel very well. Like, I actually feel a bit weak. And one of the girls saw my blood pressure and she was like, that's really low. And I was like, I'd normally have low enough blood pressure, but Jesus, that is a bit low. And it was just when I stood up and I realised that, like, my work pants had gotten really big. And even though I'd been wearing them, it took for that moment for me to kind of
put it realize together and it, realize yeah. that, yeah.
And I went into the clinic room, like, where the medications and stuff would be kept, and I weighed myself, because I don't weigh myself, like, yeah. I don't have a scales in my house or anything. And I weighed myself, and I realized, I was like, God, like, I'm technically underweight now.
Yeah.
And I felt so annoyed, because I was like, I worked so hard. It took me so long to get myself to being within a healthy range and then maintaining that.
Yeah.
And I was happy I was annoyed, because I wasn't like, oh, this is really good, you know.
Yeah.
So I knew it was a positive, but it was still hard to deal with, because I just felt like, God, now I have to not start again, but, you know, like, I have to go through a bit of this process again and, you know, really watch what I'm doing and put weight back on and stuff. But I know that's good.
Challenging your mindset is a huge part of recovery from an eating disorder. Over time, your mind has begun to believe all the destructive things you have told yourself. That you are worthless, that no one cares about you, that you need to change your appearance in order to finally be happy. Acknowledging these destructive thoughts and understanding that they are not true is vital if you want to move forward with your recovery. Cognitive behavioral therapy, or talk therapy, is an amazing tool to use to learn how to change your thought patterns.
Some days I could have a thought like, oh, do you really think you should be eating that? And I can say, I have no time for this now. Leave, go on, away with you. Like, but then it could happen another day. And depending on my mood or what's going on.
Sure, you're more vulnerable to it.
You second guess it. And then even though it could be the exact same thought on, like, at the same time of the day, you have to work really hard to counteract that. And it can be exhausting. Like, having to have these inner conversations with yourself is really draining sometimes.
If you're someone who has a loved one who has an eating disorder, or you suspect something is wrong, it can be really hard to know what to do. Do you call it out? Do you say nothing? If you want to help your loved one, firstly, understanding eating disorders will help you to do this. Eating disorders are not simply altered dietary habits. People with eating disorders use food to deal with and manage painful and uncomfortable emotions. So simply asking them to eat normally is not going to fix the core of the issue. You cannot force a person with an eating disorder to change, but you can offer them your love and support, which will undoubtedly play a huge part in their recovery. Something that people ask me a lot, and I wonder if you have any thoughts around this, are like, what do you do if you suspect a friend or a loved one is struggling? Because as you said, like, your friends, they didn't really know what to do, and then they were really brave and they went and they spoke to an adult that they trusted. But a lot of people just don't know what to do. Like, I know me personally, some people will just kind of, would you just fucking eat something, you know? Or yeah. They get aggressive about it and they're like, what is wrong with you? Like, what is wrong with you? You know, and they just don't get it. Or then some people don't talk about it at all.
Yeah.
Or then some people talk behind your back about it, and then you find out that they were talking about it behind your back, and that's really upsetting. So, like, what would you say to someone is kind of the best way to approach?
Always just ask. And I know it's so hard because, like, you feel nervous and uncomfortable and you don't want to make that person feel uncomfortable. But these conversations need to be had.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a way to do it, you know. Like, you don't just come out and say, like, oh, do you even eat anymore? Or, like, yeah. Oh, are you making yourself sick? No, like, you know, be sensitive to the area. Like, you ensure that it's just you and that person, and, you know, you have the space and the time to think. And I would say avoid statements like, you do this or you don't do that, and put it on yourself. Like, well, sometimes I feel this way, or I've noticed that you don't look well and that makes me feel scared. So you're not, yeah. You know, you're not putting it all on them. And I mean, like, they may become defensive. Yeah. Like, I definitely did. Even
I think it's probably, you know, a sure thing that most people will be defensive.
Of course, yeah.
Especially if no one has ever confronted them before about it or spoken to them, you know, because it's such a secret thing. You don't want people to know, because if people know, something has to change.
Yeah. And it's their way of coping. It's their way of control. You know, they're not doing it to hurt anyone, or like to hurt you as their family or their loved one. It's, you know, you have to remember it is a mental illness. Yeah, it is a condition.
I think that's so important for people to know, because people think it's just about the food, or it's just about the exercise, or it's just about the way you look, or it's just about the weight. And actually, it's not about any of those things.
Usually those things are only a part of it. Like, they're not, they may
and that's how it can
biggest,
start
of
yeah.
course yeah it they are coping mechanisms. I think really just being like, look, I've noticed recently that you haven't been eating a lot, or I've noticed recently that you don't seem yourself. Are you okay? I'm worried about you. Do you want to talk about it?
Yeah.
And look, I mean, as well, like, you have to remember there is only so much you can do. Like, you know, if this person is over 18, like, they are an adult, so you can be there for them. But until they're ready, you can't force it. And, like, you can reiterate that you support them, you love them, you're there for them when they need, and you can provide them with the resources. But you can't force it either, I don't think. Just be there for them, you know.
And hopefully at some point.
Yeah, and have these conversations, because they do get easier.
The first time you tell another person that you have an eating disorder will be one of the hardest things you ever do. It can feel impossible and also really frightening to say it out loud. It forces you to admit that there is a problem. It's confronting, and it feels like you are losing control. If your loved one reacts badly when you try to approach them about their eating disorder, this is completely normal. They may never have admitted it to another person, or even themselves for that matter. Learning to talk about it will take time, and it will usually happen over the course of many careful conversations. Try to avoid confrontational language and never accuse someone, but rather use terms like, I feel that there is something wrong, or I feel like you have been unhappy. Is there something I can do to help? I never said the words, I have an eating disorder, until I was 24. That was 8 years later. 8 years after mine had started. And I didn't say the words. I didn't say it out loud in private to myself. I didn't say it in my head. I didn't say it to another human being. And it was, I remember the first time I ever said it out loud. And that was the hardest thing I ever said.
Yeah.
But then once I said it, it kind of loses its power a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. It felt like that was like me, or like I would kind of say like, oh, well, like I was in hospital because I had an eating disorder. Yeah. Couldn't say anorexia.
Yeah.
For like, it was such a dirty word to me.
Yeah, so shameful or something.
Yeah, like I would be the same. It took me a very long time to kind of say like, oh, like I have anorexia, or like I am in recovery from anorexia. Yeah. But I completely agree that once you say it and you kind of start to get more comfortable with it, it doesn't seem like such a big scary thing, I don't think.
Social media is used to share everything, and it has become a significant tool for influencing others and placing value on the perfect body and appearance in a couple of key ways. Comparison is almost inevitable on social media, as we compare ourselves to unrealistic images and highly altered and edited versions of those we follow. Triggers are constant for those susceptible to eating disorders, often coming from posts about weight loss, workout routines, dieting, and the images of unrealistic ideals of body size. And it's striving for a perfection that isn't actually real. According to a recent study in children aged 12 to 17 years, peers, the media, and self-perception are the most frequently cited influencing factors on body image. According to the same study, 77% of Irish adolescents ranked body image as being important to them. 57 of the young people surveyed expressed some level of satisfaction with their body image, which means that 43% were dissatisfied. When asked about what influences their body image, comparison with others ranks as the most negative influence on a girl's body image, and bullying as the most negative influence on a boy's body image. Be mindful of who you follow. It can be motivating and fun to follow food and fitness blogs and pages, but make sure you follow the right ones. Follow those who promote positive information, making you feel good about who you are. And never be afraid to unfollow the accounts that leave you feeling bad or thinking negative thoughts about yourself.
I just think like you can never have enough awareness and stuff on topics like these, and especially, you know, like the climate that we're in, and like how social media is like just huge. Like even myself, like I'm on social media like so much.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just, I suppose it's how you use it. And you know, like don't, if you look at someone and you're like, you find that you're like comparing yourself, unfollow them.
Yeah, don't. Yeah, yeah, don't remove like, yourself from that.
Yeah,
you know,
100%.
Follow people who make you feel good about yourself.
Definitely.
And who remind you of how amazing you are and how unique you are.
Yeah.
And who never, you know, put a thought into your mind that you need to change something. Yeah. In order to be more like them.
Completely, yeah.
Because you don't. On that note, everyone should be following Clara.
Thank you.
And her handle is @Clara_hand_. Did I get that right?
I think, yeah. I should know that. I think it is, yeah.
I looked
find
it up.
Me. Thank you. I will stop talking after this. But like when I came across your Instagram as well, like talking to you, I think it's so important to like have these connections as well, that like where you can relate and stuff, you know. You've been through these things, because like I remember seeing you and being like, oh my god, like she's been through this as well. And for me, it was such a huge hope, being like, okay, like she's older than me and she has kids. Mm-hmm. Like that means that's still possible for me. And yeah, like it's just, I just think like those things are so important to have and to realize that yeah, things might be tough, and they might be tough in the future, but
yeah,
you'll get there.
If you need medical advice, please speak to a professional or contact Bodywise, the national charity for eating disorders in Ireland, on 01 210 7906. Thank you again for listening, and I hope that this conversation has been helpful to you in some way. I'm Renee Von Medding, and this has been Disordered.